Chapter 2 Kate Murphy sat on her bed at the Barbizon Hotel and listened to the news. Congress had effectively defunded the war. Nixon was finally gone. President Ford had offered amnesty to draft dodgers. Charges had been dropped against the Ohio State National Guardsmen. William Calley was free after serving less than 4 years for his part in the My Lai massacre. Kate couldn't bring herself to care. She was out of outrage. All that mattered was that the war was over. Men had finally returned home. POWs were being released. It was never going to happen again. No more boys dying in jungles. No more grieving families back home. She looked at the framed photograph by the radio. Patrick's smile offered an eerie contrast to the haggard look in his eyes. A starburst of sunlight caught the edge of his dog tags. His rifle was slung over his shoulders, helmet tilted at a jaunty angle. His shirt was off. He had new muscles she had never touched. A scar on his face that she had never kissed. The picture was black and white, but in the letter that had accompanied it, he told Kate that his normally pasty skin was lobster red. An Irish suntan. Kate had yet to meet Patrick Murphy when she watched the first draft lottery on television. She was in the living room with her family. Cold wind tapped against the window panes. Kate had a shawl wrapped around her shoulders. Her grandmother had remarked that the whole horrible process reminded her of that carnival game. What was it called? Bingo, Kate had supplied, thinking it was closer to the Shirley Jackson short story. Instead of numbered balls, there were 366 blue capsules. Inside each capsule was a slip of paper. On each slip of paper was written a number that corresponded to a month and a day of the calendar year. All the sealed capsules were mixed together in a box. Then they were dropped into a large glass jar that was so deep that the man doing the drawing had to stretch to reach the capsules with the tips of his fingers. The system was simple. As each capsule was drawn, a draft number was assigned, starting at 1 and working up to 366, which accounted for leap years. All males born between 1944 and 1950 were eligible for conscription. The month and day of your birth determined your draft number. The lower your number, the more likely you were to be drafted. A second lottery employed all 26 letters of the alphabet to determine the priority, by last name, for each date of birth. September 14th was the first date that was drawn. When it was read aloud, there was a horrible cry from the kitchen. They later found out that Mary Jane, their housekeeper, had a grandson who was born on September 14th. In the space of a few hours, every boy Kate knew had been assigned a number. No one understood what they meant, when the groups would be called up, where they would be sent, in which branch they would serve, if they were to serve at all. Lower numbers were obviously bad, but how high was high enough to be safe? Patrick Murphy and his family were asking the same questions on the other side of town. Their TV set was black and white. They had no idea the capsules were blue. What they did know was that by the end of the broadcast, their sons had been assigned numbers. Declan came in at 98, Patrick at 142. Of course, Kate didn't know any of this until much later. She met Patrick in April of 71, a little over a year after that first lottery. Kate was outside Lenox Mall, bored to death as she waited in her car for the tow truck to arrive. Her battery was dead. She'd left the lights on while she was shopping. Patrick gave her a charge. She was aware of the double entendre. So was he. He referred to it incessantly. Kate's irritation didn't stop him from flirting, which was even more irritating. Then through attrition, somewhat flattering. And then somehow, kind of intoxicating. And then it was late enough for dinner, so why not? Patrick was 21 years old, the same as her. He had a brother already serving. His father was a lawyer, He was studying to be an engineer, which seemed like one of those essential jobs you were always hearing about, like doctor or lawyer or son of a politician. Patrick was none of these. He was a big Irish Mick with a seemingly high draft number who just met the girl of his dreams. They had been together just over 15 months when he got called up. His father wasn't connected, but Kate's was. Patrick refused to allow Fayers to be called in. He didn't think it was right. And he was right that it wasn't right, but by then they were married and Kate was furious at her stupid, stubborn husband. She'd refused to see him off for basic training. When they'd kissed goodbye at the door, Kate had held on to him so tightly that he'd warned her she was going to break a rib. She wanted to break all of his ribs. She wanted to scratch out one of his eyes. She wanted to take a pipe wrench to his knee, a bat to his head. But she had to let him go, because in the end, that was all she could do. She was in love, she was married, and she was alone. And then September 14th rolled around. What were the odds? Kate was helping her parents entertain when she heard the doorbell ring. Mary Jane was in the cellar because someone had asked for wine. Kate answered the door. Instead of party guests, two soldiers were standing on the front porch. Her first thought was how odd it was to see white men wearing white cotton gloves. They were dressed identically. They stood with identically straight spines. Their uniforms were wool, long-sleeved. The weather was unseasonably warm. Beads of sweat dotted their closely shaven upper lips, rolled down the sides of their thick necks. They both took off their hats in practiced unison. She almost laughed because the synchronization was so perfect. Only one of them spoke. He called her ma'am. Kate heard the words, "Regret to inform you." Then she found herself coming round on the couch with all the party guests gone. Their half-filled glasses and still-burning cigarettes were abandoned around the room. The soldiers left her a brochure entitled "Death Benefits." "Such a phrase," her grandmother had said. An oxymoron, her father had noted. Her mother had smoked a stranger's cigarette from a nearby ashtray. Kate had no idea where the brochure was now. She didn't really care. She didn't need death benefits. She needed her husband. Lacking both, what she really needed was to get ready for work. Kate took off her robe as she walked into the bathroom. She checked to make sure her hair was securely pinned up before turning on the shower and stepping in. She gasped at the cold spray. The plumbing was menopausal, which was a funny joke considering she lived in a hotel exclusively for women. One minute the water was too cold, the next it was too hot. The stream fluctuated depending on how many women were using identical bathrooms on identical floors. If too many toilets were flushed too closely together, they were all screwed. Kate stared blankly through the translucent shower curtain as she washed. The view wasn't much. Her bed, and the wall on the other side of her bed. She closed one eye, then the other. Her vision was mottled by the green-tinted plastic curtain. She tried to remember what she had liked so much about this place when she'd first seen it. The anonymity, the sterileness, the beigeness of it all. That hadn't lasted long. Her mother had swooped in with her credit card and her good taste, and now abstract art hung on the walls. A white shag rug covered the awful tan carpet in the bedroom. And Kate's bed linens were more suited for a display window at Davison's than a downtown hotel for single women. Honestly, Kate preferred the place the way she'd found it. She turned off the taps and quickly dried herself. The bedside clock had been playing games, flipping ahead almost half an hour while she stood under the water. She would have to stop letting her mind wander. The same thing had happened this morning on the way back from breakfast at the diner. One moment she was asking a man in the street for the time, and the next she was sitting on a bench, staring up at the blue sky, as if she had all the time in the world. Daydreaming was the old Kate's luxury. She lived on her own now. She had rent to pay. She had to buy her own food and clothes. She could no longer while away the hours reading trashy paperbacks and drinking her father's gin. Death benefits. Kate tore away the plastic dry cleaner's bag and laid out her clothes on the bed. From the hallway came the hustle and bustle of girls on their way to work. She thought of them as the first shift, the office girls with their neatly bobbed hair and daringly short skirts. They were young and pretty, and still worried about what their parents thought of them, as evidenced by the fact that, as audacious as it was to live alone in the big city, they did so in an establishment that strictly forbade any male guests above the lobby floor. The second shift would follow in approximately 15 minutes. Older women like Kate, who were in their mid to late 20s. They were all personal secretaries or head tellers, career gals, independent, full of spunk. Kate loved watching them in the elevator. They were constantly checking themselves, eyeliner unsmudged, lipstick perfect, blouse tightly tucked, hem sharply pressed. Before the car reached the bottom floor, they'd reflexively checked at least three times to make sure that their stockings were straight. And then they walked across the lobby, heads held high as if they hadn't a care in the world. Between their shockingly good posture and pointy brassieres, they reminded Kate of ships sailing off to war. The clock was sneaking up on her again. Kate muttered a curse as she pulled on her underwear. She sat down on the bed and rolled on her pantyhose. She stood up to adjust the waistband. She sat back down to put on a pair of black socks. She slid into the stiff, navy blue pants and slid and slid. Oh no, she groaned. The pants were enormous. She stood up to assess the damage. Even with the belt tightly buckled, the material hung like a deflated balloon around her waist. This must have been done to her on purpose. Kate had given the supply sergeant all of her measurements. She was 5'9", hardly diminutive. But the legs of the pants were so long that they reached past her toes. A string of curses followed as she searched her underwear drawer for a pack of straight pins that she eventually found in the medicine cabinet. Kate pinned up the pant legs until the edge just grazed the top of her foot. And then she remembered the shoes. They were obviously designed for men, bulky and ugly, the sort of thing a prison warden or high school math teacher would wear. The heel was too wide. Even with the laces tight, her feet could slip out. Kate ignored the issue, settling on one problem at a time. Blisters would be the least of her worries if her pants weren't properly shortened. A few more adjustments with the pins, and the hem fell just shy of the shoelace. Good job. She allowed herself a smile of relief. Then she caught her reflection in the mirror and was too stunned to speak. She looked like a new form of centaur, a woman who was a man from the waist down. The sight would have been comical had it not been so jarring. Kate turned away from her reflection, pulling on the stiff navy blue shirt. Also too big. The collar scraped her earlobes. The breast pockets were at her waist. The emblems on the sleeves were at her elbows. She flapped up her arms, trying to get her fingers past the long sleeves. Finally, she managed to poke one hand through, then the other. She rolled the shirt cuffs until it appeared she had two large donuts on her wrists. Kate closed her eyes. No crying this morning. That was her promise. No crying until her shift was over. Laugh about this, she coached herself. Laugh because it's funny. She buttoned the shirt. Her hands were steady. Maybe this was funny. Maybe a week or a month or a year from now she would be telling the story of the first day she put on this ridiculous outfit and tears would come to her eyes. Not from the horror, but from the hilarity. She found the S-shaped metal clips that were designed to hold the utility belt. The equipment was too heavy for just one belt. She had to have one belt looped through her pants in order to support the second belt. Kate hooked one metal clip on each hip. She tried not to think a few hours ahead when the constant wear would seem like Chinese water torture. "Silly," she mumbled. "The blisters on your feet will take your mind off of it." She picked up the thick leather utility belt. This, at least, looked like it would fit. She pulled the tongue through the buckle, piercing the last hole in the belt, making sure that the metal S-hooks had taken hold underneath the edges. And then she tried not to think about Virginia Woolf walking into the river with rocks in her pockets to ensure her suicide. Flashlight on the hook, handcuffs in the pouch, radio transmitter clipped to the back, shoulder mic threaded up to the epaulette, keychain attached to the ring, nightstick through the metal loop, holster secured around the belt. Gun. Kate weighed the heavy metal revolver in her hand. She ejected the cylinder and let the brass blur as the bullets spun around. Gently, she clicked the cylinder back into place, then tucked the gun into the holster. Her fingers were oily from handling the revolver. Her thumb slipped as she snapped the leather safety strap into place. Oddly, the gun felt heavier than anything else on her hips. She'd only fired the revolver a couple of times at the police academy, and both times all she'd been thinking about was how quickly she could get away from the grabby instructor. Kate wasn't sure she'd cleaned the gun properly. The grip seemed greasier than it was supposed to be. The instructor wasn't very helpful. He'd said that he was against the arming of females. Honestly, having spent 2 weeks with the rest of the women in her class, Kate shared the man's reticence. There were a few serious recruits, but many were there on a lark. More than half of them signed up for the typing pool, where they'd receive the same pay as officers on patrol. Only 4 women in Kate's group had asked for street assignments. In retrospect, maybe Kate should have paid more attention in typing class, or secretarial school, or paralegal training, or any number of the jobs she tried and failed at before seeing a story in the Atlanta Journal about women police officers being trained for motorcycle patrol. Motorcycle patrol. Kate laughed at her naivete. If the firearms instructors were loath to train women, the motorcycle division was downright hostile to the idea of women on bikes. The riding instructor wouldn't even allow them inside the garage. The bedside clock clicked as the numbers turned over. Time had jumped forward again. Noises filled the hallway. The career gals heading out to work. Soft voices, occasional laughter, the swish, swish, swish of nylons rubbing against slim skirts. The hat was last. Kate had worn hats before. They were all the rage in high school, pillbox mostly, like Mrs. Kennedy. Kate had found a leopard skin to match the Dylan song. She'd pinned it at a rakish angle that made Kate's mother send her straight back to her room. This hat would have sent her mother into apoplexy. Dark blue and, as with everything else to do with her uniform, overly large. Wide brim. Gold, round badge sewn onto the center. City of Atlanta Police Department. Inside the circle was a phoenix ascending from the ashes. Resurgence. Latin, rising again. Kate put on the hat. She looked at her reflection in the mirror. She could do this. She had to do this. Chapter 3. Fox sat in his car smoking a cigarette. The windows were rolled up tight. Smoke filled the space. He thought of tear gas. Not for the first time, not for the last. The needle wouldn't skip on that record. Lacrimatory agents, they were called, which was a fancy way of saying your eyeballs were going to be impaled on spikes. 20 seconds of exposure was all it took. The gas overstimulated the corneal nerves. Pain. Tears. Coughing, sneezing, and blindness followed. boot camp. Fox had stood with the men in his unit as they watched the first team get gassed. The exposure was supposed to toughen them up, prepare them for jungle warfare, but what it did was break them down. Grown men screamed like little girls. They tried to scratch out their eyes. They begged for mercy. Fox had watched them writhe around like worms and thought they were idiots. They had all gotten the same briefing. Sure, it hurt, but you just had to wait it out. 30 minutes later, you were fine. 30 minutes was nothing. You could do anything for 30 minutes. Then, it was Fox's turn to be gassed. Hot tears blistered his eyes. He inhaled needles into his lungs. He panicked. He dropped to the floor. He begged for mercy just like all the worms who had come before him. That was where the shame came from. Not the crying or the choking, but the begging. Only once before in his life had Fox ever begged for anything. He was 12 years old, and he had quickly learned that there was no use begging because nobody was going to help you but yourself. So, 12-year-old Fox had vowed that his begging days were over. And then, 7 years later, he was at Camp Bumfuck rolling around on the floor alongside 20 other grunts like a helpless, pitiful worm. Should Fox take even a little bit of pride in the fact that he wasn't the one begging the loudest? A guy from his unit had died from exposure. Undiagnosed asthmatic, the brass had said, but who trusted the brass? Probably they were trying out a new formula on their own men before sending the caustic gas into the field. Wasn't the first time. Wouldn't be the last. War was nothing but a grand experiment. Behind every senseless tragedy, there was some guy with a clipboard. Fox had a clipboard of his own. He glanced down at his log. 0546. Exited building. Talked to no one. 0600. Breakfast at diner. Usual table. Usual waitress. One hard-boiled egg, dry toast, black coffee. Red paper, left 25-cent tip. 0628, walked opposite direction from building, down 14th and around block. 0639, asked unknown businessman for time. 0651, sat on bench outside bank building, stared up at sky. 0658, rose from bench, went into apartment building. Now what? Fox opened the glove box. He saw the pantyhose that had covered his face last night. Her pantyhose. The scope of the mission was changing. Fox could feel the shift almost like he was standing on a rug that was being slowly pulled from beneath his feet. This had happened before. Fox would be doing one thing, but somewhere in the back of his brain, his thoughts were mulling over other courses of action. All it took was some kind of lightning to strike. The bolt would hit his skull, and the thing in the back of his brain would jump to the front. And like that, he had options. Fox took out his binoculars and used them to find the familiar window. As he watched, the curtains were opened. He smiled at his luck. Sometimes he missed the curtains. Sometimes he would look up and his guts would turn to liquid because he had no idea how long ago the curtains had been opened, whether or not he had missed something important. But today, he saw her open the curtains. Fox noted a new time in his log, 4 minutes from now, because he knew that's how long it took for the elevator to arrive on the correct floor. The short ride down to the lobby, the next elevator down to the parking garage, the quick walk to the right space, and bingo, exactly 4 minutes later, Fox watched Kate Murphy pull her car out of the underground garage. Christ, she was beautiful. The way the sun hit her face. He could almost let himself forget about her dirty little secret. Fox rolled down his window to let out the smoke. He put the clipboard on the passenger's seat. Then, he followed her. Chapter 4. Terry's anger pushed a low pressure into the car that reminded Maggie of the way she felt when a tornado was about to touch down. Her head throbbed. Her blood felt thick. The hairs on the back of her neck stood at a permanent attention. They should have been able to have a conversation about what had happened to Don and Jimmy. Two cops stuck in a car. It was normal for them to discuss the shooting, talk out what they were going to do next to make sure the killer was brought to justice. But Terry didn't think of Maggie as a cop. And Maggie sure as hell didn't think of her uncle as a confidant. So they both stared grimly out the window and kept their thoughts to themselves. Besides, justice was probably the last thing on Terry's mind. He wouldn't be thinking about what had happened this morning. He would be thinking about the cop killer who had gotten away with murder. Last January, Detective Duke Abbott had been shot in the chest while sitting in his parked car behind the City Motel off Moreland Avenue. His partner was inside the motel, doing what you'd expect a cop to be doing inside a motel at 2 o'clock in the morning when he was supposed to be working a shift. Duke was a white cop. Witnesses had seen a black man leaving the scene. By the time the morning paper hit the stands, the city was wound up like an alarm clock strapped to 1,000 sticks of dynamite. Within 3 days of the murder, they'd had a suspect's name. Edward Spivey was a mid-level drug dealer and pimp who operated in the vicinity of the motel. A couple of witnesses had identified Spivey as the man leaving the scene of the crime. One claimed he saw Spivey ditch a gun in a sewer grate. The other said Spivey had blood on his shirt. Terry led the team that had found both the gun and the bloody shirt. For nearly a week, they turned the city upside down looking for Spivey. The suspect proved to be more cunning than any of them anticipated. Instead of running, Spivey turned himself in. He invited a local news crew to meet him on the steps of the station house. He shouted out his innocence. He said the evidence was planted, the witnesses bribed. He hired a fancy lawyer from up north. He talked to any reporter who showed up at the jailhouse. He practically dared the city to send him to the electric chair. Normally, the city would have gladly obliged. But between Duke Abbott's murder and Edward Spivey's trial, Atlanta had gone through a radical change. The newly elected black mayor had delivered on his promise to bring diversity to local government, which was good or bad, depending on how you looked at it. Before the transition, a black man accused of shooting a white cop would have gone straight to death row. But then the ballots were counted and an all-black jury let Edward Spivey walk out of the courthouse, a free man. The resulting rift between the police and the district attorney's office made the Grand Canyon look like a crack in the sidewalk. If Maggie had to guess, she would have said that the only thing on Terry's mind right now was making sure that Don Wesley's killer never saw the inside of a courtroom. The car jerked as Terry took a left into the parking lot down from police headquarters. The Buick sailed into its regular space. Maggie moved in tandem with her uncle. He put the gear into park. She pulled the door handle and got out of the car. There was a brief moment of relief. Then Maggie found herself facing a wall of duplicate Terrys. Same cropped haircuts. Same bushy mustaches. Same kind of anger flashing in their beady little eyes. Terry's friends all had names like Bud and Mac and Red, and talked about the good old days like preachers talked about heaven. They all had multiple ex-wives, angry mistresses, and grown children who wouldn't talk to them. Worse, they were all the same kind of cop as Terry. They always knew better than everybody else. They never listened to anyone from the outside. They carried throwaway guns in their ankle holsters. They kept their Klan robes hanging in the back of their closets. Maggie couldn't remember a time in her life when Terry's friends were not around. Not because of Terry, but because of Jimmy. They attended all of his football games. They dropped by practice to offer the coach unsolicited pointers. They slipped Jimmy cash to go on dates. They bought him beer before he was old enough to drink. When Jimmy's knee blew out, They had given him a police escort to the hospital. Maggie had thought that their hero worship would end with Jimmy's football career, but in some ways, they seemed happier to have Jimmy on the job than they were to see him on the field. The day Jimmy had graduated from the academy, the first two rows of the audience were filled with his cheering squad. They all loved him like a son. They mentored him. They told him stories. They offered advice. And sometimes, if they were drunk enough, they even let Maggie listen.
Hey!
Jet Elliott banged his fist on the roof of the car. He was so drunk he could barely stand.
We're not letting this one get away with it, you hear me? Damn straight we're not.
Mac McKay shored up Jet with an arm around his shoulder.
We're gonna take care of this ourselves.
There were grunts of agreement as a flask was passed around. Maggie pulled her purse onto her shoulder, but she couldn't go anywhere. The wall of Terry's had managed to both block her path and completely ignore her. Les Leslie leaned against the car.
Boss already put in a call to California. 3-hour time difference, but they'll get somebody to lay eyes on him.
He was talking about Edward Spivey. After the trial, the man had moved to the other side of the continent, but no one believed he would stay there for long.
Ought to fly out there ourselves, Red Fleming said. Lay more than eyes on him.
Terry slammed the car door.
Think they'll let us take a noose on the plane? I got two in my trunk.
Jet grabbed at the flask. Mac pushed him away.
Fuck off.
Jet pushed back.
You fuck off.
Maggie took advantage of the shoving match and headed toward the street. She didn't want to be around when they really got wound up. Red held out his arm to stop her.
Jimmy all right?
She nodded as she eyed the exit. He's fine.
He's coming in, Terry said. Wouldn't stay home. Damn right he wouldn't.
Les passed the flask to Terry.
We taking care of business today?
Hell yeah.
Terry took a healthy drink.
Gonna put that fucker in the ground, am I right?
You're goddamn right.
Jet grabbed the flask from Terry.
No trial for this asshole. Only walk he's taken is to the grave.
There were more murmurs of agreement. Maggie tried to edge around Red.
Need to keep Jim out of this,
Red mumbled under his breath. Everyone heard him. Nods went around. Maggie was both annoyed and jealous. To a man, they would all lay down their lives protecting Jimmy Lawson.
Terry said, You got somewhere to be?
Maggie realized he was talking to her. She didn't feel her usual impulse to do the opposite of what her uncle said. She started toward the street, glad to be away from them. The relief didn't last long. She was never going to get away from these assholes. A black Eldorado was pulling into the parking lot. The window slid down. Bud Deacon had his hands gripped around the steering wheel. Chip Bigsby was in the passenger seat. He looked worse than the rest of them. His cheeks were more sunken than usual. His lips were a weird blue. Probably from smoking too much. Of all of Terry's friends, Chip was the least offensive, which wasn't saying much. Maggie preempted the question.
Jimmy's all right, he's coming in.
That ain't right, Bud said. You should have told him to stay home.
She wanted to laugh. You think he listens to me?
Shut that smart mouth before I do,
Bud warned.
Is it too much to ask you to be there for your brother?
Maggie chewed her lip so she wouldn't speak her mind.
It's gonna be hard for him.
Chip's voice was solemn. Duke Abbott had been his partner. Chip had been inside the motel when Duke was shot. He was also sitting behind Edward Spivey when the jury came back with an acquittal. Two deputies had to hold him down. If one of them hadn't grabbed Chip's gun, he'd probably be sitting on death row right now. Maggie said, Jimmy knows he's not alone.
Doesn't matter, Chip said. Something like this happens, you're alone for the rest of your life.
Maggie didn't know what to say.
She'd known Chip forever, but it wasn't like they sat around talking about their feelings. Chip seemed to realize this, too. He told Bud, "Let's go." Maggie watched the car roll into the parking lot. She quickened her pace again. She didn't want to think about the plans Terry and his friends were making. As a cop, she had a duty to make sure the law was upheld. But she was a cop, and she wasn't going to rat out other cops. Besides, the men were detectives. Maggie was patrol. She was also a woman. No one would listen to her. And even if they did, they wouldn't care unless the Atlanta Constitution ran a story on it. All Maggie could do for now was handle what was in front of her. And right now, what was in front of her was getting ready for work. She dug around in her purse as she crossed the street. The brick that was the transmitter for her radio took up half the space in her bag. She clipped it onto the back of her belt, then jacked in the springy cord to her shoulder mic. Maggie checked the dials on top of the transmitter. There were two, one for volume, one for tuning. She could adjust both in her sleep. Cash from her wallet went into her front pocket. Two pens and a small notepad went into her left breast pocket. Her citation book went into the right one. Chemical mace went into her back pocket, along with a tube of nude lipstick. Neither one was regulation, but a girl had to protect herself. She cataloged the remaining items in her purse, a paperback, loose change, a darker lipstick, powder, mascara, blusher, eyeliner. The latter items were not necessary for the job, but necessary if she wanted to keep them from Lily. A breeze rustled Maggie's hair as she stepped onto the sidewalk. The sharp pain in her knee was gone. The sensation was more like she was aware that she had a knee, rather than that she was about to collapse with every step. She didn't know how Jimmy dealt with the constant discomfort every day. Of course, she didn't know how her brother dealt with a lot of things. Either Jimmy was lying about what had happened during the shooting, or he'd taken the time to clean his gun before leaving the hospital. Considering the half-assed job he'd done of cleaning his own face, she doubted the latter explanation. What was more likely was that he hadn't fired the revolver at all. In which case, what else was he lying about? Had the shooter's gun really jammed? Because Maggie had been on the firing range enough times to know what happened when a gun jammed. She had it happen herself. She'd seen it happen to others. The sequence was always the same. You pulled the trigger, nothing happened. You pulled the trigger again, maybe even a third or fourth time, before you accepted that the gun was jammed. The process was like sniffing bad milk or tasting something that was too spicy. You always had to do it more than once. You never believed something was off the first time. Maggie stopped walking. She looked down at her watch. When the second hand hit the 12, she mentally walked herself through the shooter's movements. Turn the corner, aim, shoot Don Wesley, recoil, aim, pull the trigger, nothing. Pull the trigger again, run. 5, maybe 6 seconds. That was assuming there was no hesitation, and that the shooter was able to re-aim quickly even though Jimmy had to be moving the moment Don went down. Maggie started walking again. A second lasted longer than most people thought. The blink of an eye takes around 300 milliseconds. The act of breathing in and out eats up around 5 seconds. An average marksman can pull his weapon in under 2 seconds. Jimmy Lawson was one of the best marksmen in their division. In 5 or 6 seconds, he could easily kill a man. Maggie turned the corner and almost ran into another cop. He had coffee-colored skin and was wearing a too-tight uniform that made him look like a first-day recruit. His hands went up immediately, another sign that he was new. She told him, "Take the next left. Headquarters is on the left, halfway up." He tipped his hat. "Thank you, ma'am." Maggie continued up the sidewalk. The man jogged across the street and preceded her along the other side. She'd forgotten the academy had spit out a class of new graduates. There could not have been a worse day for new recruits to start. On top of dealing with the fallout from Don Wesley's murder, they'd have to step over a bunch of flailing newbies who, if past was prologue, would wash out before the middle of the week. Instead of taking a left on Central Avenue, Maggie kept going straight for two more blocks. The Do Right Diner specialized in bland food and weak coffee, but its location ensured a loyal clientele. The place was empty but for two customers in the back. No one ate here unless they were on the clock, and roll call wouldn't start for another 40 minutes.
"Jimmy all right?" the waitress asked.
"He's great, thanks." Maggie kept walking toward the back. Two women in various states of undress were lounging across a circular banquet. Torn stockings, micro-minis, heavy makeup, and blonde wigs. These were all perks that came with being a PCO, or plainclothes officer. The women were part of the new John Task Force, which, as far as anyone could tell, was a money-making scheme that kept rich white bankers out of jail. Gail Patterson winked at Maggie around the smoke from her cigarette. Her deep, South Georgia twang played perfectly with her undercover getup.
"Looking for some action, Mama?"
Maggie laughed, hoping her face didn't look as red as it felt. Her first year on the job had been spent in a cruiser with Gail. The senior officer was gruff and ornery, and undoubtedly the best teacher Maggie had ever had.
"I need a bounce."
The other woman downed a glass of orange juice with a loud gulp. Her name was Mary Peterson. Maggie only knew her by reputation. She was a divorcee who had a thing for cops. Of course, that's what they said about all the women on the force, that they joined because they had a thing for cops, so Maggie didn't really know. Mary's vinyl skirt squeaked as she slid out of the booth.
"Jimmy all right?"
"He's fine."
"Good. You tell him we're here for him."
She patted Maggie on the shoulder as she left. Gail waved at the vacated spot.
"Rest your dogs, chickie."
"Thanks."
Maggie unclipped the transmitter from the back of her belt and sat down. The seat was still warm. She leaned into the soft foam. Suddenly, her eyes wanted to close. Her body started to relax. Maggie had been tense from the moment she'd entered her mother's kitchen. Gail took off her wig and dropped it on the table.
"You look as tired as I feel."
"Guilty," Maggie admitted.
"You look good."
Gail laughed out some smoke.
"Fucking liar."
Maggie was lying. Gail looked like an old whore, which was only partly due to the way she had to dress for work. She was 42 years old. Her skin was showing wrinkles. Her hair was too black to be natural. There was a heaviness to her cheeks and eyelids. She had a deep cleft between her eyebrows that came from always scrutinizing everything around her. God forbid if Gail didn't like what she saw. Everybody was afraid of her nasty temper. She had come up when there were no federal grants paving the way for women on the force. She'd fought tooth and nail to get her PCO rank. She was part of the old guard, Terry's group, and like everybody else, she was terrified of losing her status. Gail asked,
"How's Jimmy really doing?"
Maggie told the truth.
"I have no idea. He never talks to me."
"Sounds about right."
She kept her cigarette in one hand as she used her fork to cut into a stack of pancakes.
"You ask out that neighbor of yours yet?"
Maggie hadn't come to the diner to talk about her miserable dating prospects. "What have you heard about the shooting?"
"I heard the killer's gonna be taking no walk like Edward Spivey."
"Besides that." Gail studied her. She chewed, then took a smoke, then chewed some more. Finally, she asked,
"Did you know Don?"
"Not really, he was Jimmy's friend."
Gail exhaled slowly.
"I knew him."
Maggie waited for more.
"He had a sweet side."
Gail stared off into the distance.
"That's the ones you always have to worry about, the assholes who aren't assholes all the time."
"An asshole is always an asshole."
"That's your youth talking."
She put down her fork.
"This job changes you, baby doll, whether you like it or not.
You bust balls long enough, you don't want to come home to a man who rolls over when you tell him to.
She winked. You want to be the one rolling over.
The only thing Maggie wanted to come home to these days was a quiet house and clean laundry.
It's when they're gentle that you start to lose yourself.
Gail was suddenly wistful.
They're all strong and silent, and then one day, hell, not even a day, maybe a second, 2 seconds if you're lucky, this sweet side comes out and...
She snapped her fingers.
You're a goner.
Maggie felt slow on the uptake.
You knew Don.
She shrugged.
He wasn't so bad when you got him alone.
Maggie picked at a dried glob of syrup glued to the table. She had always looked up to Gail. She was good at her job. She had a husband who loved her. She was Maggie's idea of what being a successful policewoman was all about.
Oh, kid, don't be disappointed in me.
I'm not, Maggie lied.
You know I love trouble.
Maggie smiled at the old joke. Her husband's nickname was Trouble. Gail sighed out a flume of smoke.
I never see him, and when I do, all we do is fight about money and which bill is gonna get paid first, and what are we gonna do about my sister's deadbeat husband, and how long can we put off before his mother has to come live with us?
She gave a half-hearted shrug.
Sometimes it's a relief to be with somebody who only wants you for one thing.
It's your business. You don't have to explain it to me.
Damn right I don't.
She reached into her purse and pulled out a flask. All the upper ranks carried booze on them. Maggie watched Gail take a large mouthful. Then another.
Jesus, I hate it when the good ones die. Fought that fucking war and came back here so another American could shoot him in an alley.
Maggie wondered how many breakfast tables she was going to have to sit around before she got a straight answer out of somebody. She repeated, "What have you heard about the shooting?" Gail glanced at the waitress before responding.
"That hippy-dippy girlfriend of his, what's her name, Pocahontas? She made a scene at the hospital."
Maggie had met the woman once. She had brown skin and jet-black hair that she wore in a long braid down her back. How'd she find out?
Heard it on the scanner. Don had one at his apartment.
I didn't know they were living together.
She laughed. Neither did he.
Maggie laughed too, but only so the moment wouldn't turn more awkward. She echoed Terry's words. They'll get him anyway. Whoever did this, 5 dead cops, you can only run for so long.
Well, they'll get somebody.
Maggie didn't ask for clarification. There had been questions about exactly how Terry had come up with a tossed gun and bloody shirt that tied Edward Spivey to Duke Abbott's murder. The shitty part was that the case had been strong without the evidence. Unfortunately, most of the jurors came from Atlanta's ghettos. They had seen too many cops plant too many pieces of evidence to believe this might be the one time that everything had been done by the book.
Anyway, Gail tipped her flask into her coffee cup. They got all zones called in. Everybody's on overtime. Nobody goes home until it's over.
Everybody? Maggie couldn't begin to imagine how much that would cost. They didn't even do that with Duke.
Duke was different.
They were both cops.
Don't play coy, gal. You know it ain't the same. Duke was in a bad place at a bad time. This is Terry Lawson's nephew out on the job, almost taking 2 in the head.
2?
That's the word at the station.
She pointed to the side of her head.
Don had 1 here?
She moved her finger to her cheek. And 1 here. Maggie could tell they were both thinking the same thing. Those are hard shots to make.
Just 1 of them's hard. 2 of them? That far from the target? Cheap throwaway gun? That's paladin territory.
It's different from the shooter, Maggie said. The other 4 got it once each in the forehead, point-blank range, execution style. Gail eyed her carefully.
You're thinking it's the Atlanta shooter?
Aren't you?
The shooter's still out there. We went balls to the walls the last two times and came up with fucking zero. And the murder this morning, the boys were in an alley when Don was shot, same as the other four victims.
Gail shrugged.
What do I know? Could all just be a crazy coincidence.
Sure. One of the first lessons Gail had taught Maggie was that there was no such thing as a coincidence.
Gail asked, You hear about the tires?
They were slashed.
Gail tipped her lighter end over end, making a tapping sound against the table.
I know a gal in dispatch said he didn't call it in.
What do you mean?
Jimmy didn't call a 63.
Officer down. The call was standard procedure when a cop was injured.
Gail said, Dispatch didn't even know that Don was hurt until they got a call from one of the docs at Grady saying he was dead.
Maggie looked down. The transmitter for her radio was by her leg. Everybody on the force carried a radio. PCOs like Gail kept them in their purses. Patrol wore them clipped to the back of their belts. They were ungainly, thicker than a paperback, heavy as a can of Crisco, and covered in a plastic shell with knife-sharp edges. You either took it off when you sat down, or you sat on the edge of your seat to keep from puncturing your spine. Maggie said, They could have been in a dead pocket. There were pockets all over the city where the radios didn't work. They were in 5 points off Whitehall. Reception can be patchy over there.
Gail's eyebrow went up. She worked in the area. She knew the dead spots. What she didn't know was something Maggie had just realized. Jimmy's transmitter had been missing from his belt this morning. She could see it clearly in her mind's eye. Keys, nightstick, handcuffs, revolver. But no transmitter.
Hey, kid!
Gail tapped the table with her lighter.
You in there?
Maggie looked at her watch. She thought about her earlier experiment. 5 seconds. That was a long time. Even longer if Don was shot twice. Jimmy had maybe 7 or 8 seconds to respond. Or not, as the case might have been.
Gail knocked on the table again.
Am I talking to myself here?
Maggie looked up. Where'd you work last night?
Not at the 5, if that's what you're asking. I was off. This is for today.
Gail indicated her skimpy outfit.
I'm bait for the Johns. Zones 2 and 3 are lending their umbrella cars to round up the pimps. They're hoping to shut down business.
That should bring out the snitches.
Yeah, but when?
She took one last hit before stubbing out her cigarette.
All it's gonna do is waste time. Same with the reward money. We already got 1 million leads from the last 2 shootings, bunch of women turning in their husbands and boyfriends, trying to get that $5,000.
Maggie had run down enough false leads to know the truth behind her statement. How is shutting down the streets wasting time? It worked with Edward Spivey.
Did it?
Maggie shrugged. Terry had gotten Spivey's name off a snitch by using the same tactics. There had to be some worth in that.
Let me lay it out for you, Gail said. We're looking for some working gal who saw something in the 5 last night, right? We're hoping maybe she'll give us a name.
Maggie nodded.
So this is how one day goes down. Our boys are gonna throw every pimp they can find into the slammer. Lock up the pimps, then the girls spend all day getting high and sleeping.
Maggie nodded again. That was exactly what had happened the last time.
Day 2 rolls around. The pimps bail out, they beat up the girls for being lazy, the girls rush into the streets to make up for lost revenue.
She lit a fresh cigarette.
Which brings us to day 3. Our boys come in and lock up the whores.
She spun her lighter on the table.
It's a revolving door, in and out, day 4, day 5, however long it takes. They're gonna keep up this giant pissing contest until finally somebody turns snitch so that everybody can get back to work.
That's what we want, though. We need somebody to talk.
Yeah, but does that seem like a smart way to do it?
She leaned across the table.
What did I get up to, 5, 6 days? Meanwhile, whoever killed Don Wesley's already melting the murder weapon in a vat of acid and getting the hell out of town. Or worse, hiring some fancy lawyer from up north who thinks he's gonna take a walk.
Edward Spivey again. Everything they did today would be cast in the man's shadow.
Maggie asked, "What's the faster option?"
"We find out the name of the pimp who's running girls where the murder went down. Then we get the pimp to set up a meet with his girls so we can talk to them. You know how it is. Them whores won't take a shit lest their pimp tells them to. And most times, he charges some freak to watch it."
Maggie almost laughed.
"It's that easy? Just go to the pimp and he'll let us talk to his girls?"
"It's easy if we do it. If the boys do it, then we're looking at our very own Ted offensive."
She shrugged, like it was a foregone conclusion.
"Chicks are better at de-escalating the situation. You know that."
"Yeah," Maggie said, though this was a lot coming from a woman she'd seen crack open a suspect's head with her Kel light.
Gail asked, "You ever break up a fight between two guys?"
"Sure."
Maggie did it at least 5 times a week. "They don't stop beating the shit out of each other because they're scared of you, right?"
"No."
Sometimes, all it took was the sight of her squad car to break up a fight. After the first couple of punches, they want somebody to stop them before they really get hurt. I'm just the excuse.
"Correctamundo," Gail said. "So why go through all this trouble and drag it out with our boys banging up their boys and their boys banging up ours when we gals can just talk like semi-reasonable people?"
"What gals?"
"We gals."
She indicated the space between them. Maggie tried to think it through. "How do we know they're not lying?"
"How do we know the snitches are telling the truth?"
She had raised a good point. "Have you told this idea to the bosses?"
"Yeah, Mac and Les and Terry and them all fell to the floor and kissed my feet for being so damn brilliant."
Maggie grinned at the joke. 5 points. A million girls work that area.
"We're not talking 5 points. We're talking Whitehall. And not just Whitehall, but the section near the CNS bank where Don got shot. Them whores working that strip are older bitches. Most of them are shooting coke and horse 8-balls. Not much life left, which makes this time sensitive."
Maggie knew older meant around her own age.
"Okay, so we need the name of the pimp who owns that corner. Do you have any sources who might talk?"
"Sure I do, but I got some bad blood on the street right now. Might have been too hard on a couple of whores got in my way."
Gail tapped her cigarette in the ashtray.
"You know me, kid. Never met a bridge I couldn't burn. I know who's got the information, just might need some help prying it out."
Maggie felt her toes start to tingle. She was walking along the edge of a very steep cliff.
"I'm not a detective."
"So what?"
Gail stared a challenge into her. This was how Maggie got roped in every time. She wanted Gail's approval too much.
"Look, go a couple of steps out. I get the name from a source. Then what? Pimp ain't gonna talk to me. You know how those bastards are. They want to talk to some pretty young thing still got her tits where they're supposed to be."
Maggie felt her stomach pitch. Gail had obviously given this some thought.
"You think I can just stroll into some pimp's lair and he's gonna talk to me?"
"Listen, sweetheart. Forget what I told you when we were back in patrol. If there's one thing I've learned from being PCO, it's that sometimes it's okay to use the fact that you're a woman."
Maggie wasn't so sure about that.
"Not like you gotta do anything after that except sit back and watch."
Maggie knew what she was saying. Give Terry the name, then let the guys take care of the problem. Gail jammed her cigarette into the stack of pancakes.
"Listen, this is a yes or no question. You want to say yes, meet me at the Colonnade restaurant around 2. You say no, and the guy who murdered Don, almost killed your brother,
Gets away with it again? Gale shrugged. That's on you.